My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Tom Sumner. Tom, welcome to KBO.
Thank you, Ed. Thanks for having me.
You contacted me about a few books that you're doing. The one that I've been reading recently is entitled Project Rewire. It's a bunch of essays, blog essays, actually, taken off the web with an introductory essay about the state of American journalism by Judy Dabenmeyer. But I guess the question is, let's back up a minute. What's your publisher is William James and Company.
Correct.
What's the mission of William James and Company?
Well, in this series, the mission is to give a voice to the media outlets that are out there, but they're not being represented in print. This is a great example of what we're doing, this new book, Project Rewire. And the reason why it's such a good example of it is that the thesis of the book is that media is being restructured as we speak. The regular outlets of television and newsprint are being not subverted, but they're being most heavily questioned and most have the spotlight shown on them by the internet media.
I'm willing to say subverted.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, if Fox News is not subversion, then what is it?
That's right.
Yeah. So there's a series of books based on internet blogs. Now, if anybody doesn't know what a blog is, it's a weblog, a kind of an online journal. And there's the blogosphere, as it's known. All these words are kind of amazing, aren't they, the blogosphere?
Well, they're words that we didn't know, obviously, 10 years ago.
5 years ago.
Hardly any of us knew them 5 years ago. Oh, yeah. But most people know what a blog is. Mm-hmm. We did a book a couple of years ago called Blogging America. And in that title, Barbara O'Brien of the Maha blog laid out the foundation of where political blogging came from, what it came from. And essentially what happened was in the late 1990s, when technology and the web had reached a point that it was pretty freely available, a lot of political blogging was done from the right, mainly targeting Clinton administration. When George Bush was elected, even more tools for blogging became available, and very obviously the left had something big to write about. It almost, let's see, Madeleine Albright says about 9/11, what does she say? She says, well, it really took that catastrophic event to focus our attention on this problem. Well, the catastrophic event in the case of blogs was the election of George Bush and the need to expose the level of corruption that has gone on in the administration. And it has only mushroomed since then.
I suggest it's a catastrophe way beyond the blogosphere.
Sure.
Yeah, okay. As I look at the cover of Project Rewire, I see some stars here, people like Joshua Micah Marshall, people like David Sirota, people like Russ Baker. Is he the son of Russell Baker?
He's not related to Russell Baker. He used to write under the name Russell Baker and realized very quickly that he was being confused with
indeed another
Russell Baker. Yeah. He knew there was another Russell Baker, but when he started getting published in larger media outlets, he realized he'd better start going by something that was more distinctive. Well, Russ Baker. Still confusing, but at least he sticks with Russ and not Russell.
Uh-huh. There were some people I was I personally was aware of, but I had not heard of Bob Summerby, and I have not heard of the guy who calls himself the angry media guy. These guys are really something. I mean, the blog gives you because you're publishing yourself, you can say pretty much whatever you like. There's no editor there saying, well, you know, we can't say this. You know, this is a little bit inflammatory. So these guys really vent their spleens online. How did you find these guys?
Well, if you don't know Bob Summerby, you absolutely everybody should know Bob Summerby. There's nobody quite like him. He runs the blog and has since the sometime 98 or so, called the Daily Howler.
And indeed it is.
It is a howler. And his background, he's a comedian, sort of a political comedian, I suppose. I don't want to call him a modern-day Mort Saul, but, you know, he's definitely of a stripe that doesn't exist in spades anymore.
You never put that kind of a burden on somebody to call them the new Mort Sahl.
No, that's right.
Because they feel like I might have to live up to it.
That's right. No, but he's obviously operating in the same arena, using extremely. He gets pretty inflammatory, and his focus is on media criticism. He watches way more cable news than I ever could. And he gets a lot out of it, and it's a way for his site, the Daily Howler, is a place where someone can go who has no desire to read cable, to watch cable news, to find out what's being aired on there and what, you know, millions of Americans are seeing every single night.
You know, the thing that people have about, you know, picking up the Band-Aid to look at the infected scab underneath. You ever watch Bill O'Reilly?
Sure, yeah.
It's that same kind of fascination. You know, in a way, he's even worse than Limbaugh. You look at this guy, and he's like a pustule on the surface of humanity.
Well, he's very he's a case for – I mean, you could psychoanalyze the man to death just watching his program.
It should only happen.
Reading the novels that he writes, lurid you know,
yes, the loofah incident.
Yes, and his sexual harassment cases. I mean, you know, and yet going out, having the guts or
temerity,
the nerve,
yeah.
To go out every night and just spout off about morality and
to write a book.
Yes.
Write a book of moral instruction for children.
Exactly.
Yes,
yeah.
But we're not really here to talk about Bill O'Reilly. Thank heaven. Something occurred to me. There's a kind of inherent irony in this. One of the things about the web is that it's in a way ephemeral, that it's there every day, but it's gone the next day unless you want to go to the archives of the various websites and blogs that you can go to. And so isn't there something a little inherently contradictory about a hard copy book of blogs?
Well, you might think so, although, you know, I go through these books now and then, and I'm always reminded things that, you know, maybe I've seen them before, or I had seen them put a different way in another, but really it's kind of a living history. If you look at what was said, you know, that day, journalism always, you know, is put out, well, it's history's first draft, but we've never had so much first draft the availability of information is so vast now on the internet that anybody who has good insight can contextualize something very quickly, much more quickly than I think it was possible in the past. Tomes had to be written about what really happened, and then you could go back and analyze it. Well, here we have an on-the-fly writing of history, and it's interesting to me to go back through these books that have collected material from the internet and see what was written on the day that this event happened or that event happened. And it's also, you know, I want to make the point that not everything that's written on the internet is so ephemeral that it should just fall off into the archives and be forgotten. And we make a lot of effort in these books to go through the material and find the stuff that people would want to read again, find things that are engaging writing. A lot of what you see on the blogosphere, if you hook into a blog, is check this out with a link. Well, that's hardly something that's worth remembering. Perhaps you'll remember the story that's linked, but you know, they're steering you towards stories in many cases. But there are many, many writers on the internet who don't have an outlet anywhere in print, and this is a place where they can, you know, have a shot at showing up in a book.
Well, there's something which I'll coin a phrase, the Wikipedia effect. Okay, what I mean by that is this is an online encyclopedia called the Wikipedia, and the thing is anybody can participate in the writing of the Wikipedia. I mean anybody. If you get a wild hair to write about New World monkeys, you can go to the Wikipedia and enter an article about New World monkeys, whether you know what you're talking about or not. Now, one of the problems I have with guys like Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and people like that is that they never check their facts. And in fact, they just BS. They'll make stuff up as they go along if it helps to prove whatever point they're making. When on the blogosphere, who's guarding the guardians on the blogosphere? Do you fact check these guys before you put their stuff in print?
Yeah, well, there are two points about that. One thing is if we're putting it into a book, it's something that, you know, we can find in more than one source to back it up, an assertion. Obviously, a lot of what gets written on blogs is punditry. Taking a little fact or a little news story that's being reported and offering insight and contextualization of it. So, it is checked. And in fact, blogs are, you know, there is an opportunity. I mean, there's a couple of points here. One is an independent blogger, somebody just writing a blog on his own, has an opportunity. You may question the resources that they have to back up what they're saying, and you may question, you know, even their opinion on it or the source itself. But one thing that you really cannot question is why they are saying it. And in corporate media, you'll find on cable news, there's every reason to question why this story is being emphasized now. Corporations are footing the bill. They're not going to do something that is contrary to their own agenda. Or
economic interest.
Exactly, economic interest. And an independent blogger, you know, these people are very, very often, you know, it's hard to go by a week if you're reading blogs regularly without finding one of them saying, look, can anybody pitch in and help me foot the internet bill this month?
Yeah.
And that's really where they're operating from. It's from a level of wanting to be directly involved with the story and helping to get it out. And if, you know, this is one of the great things, or not a great thing, but this is one of the things about the Iraq War was the mea culpas that were published years after the fact from the New York Times, the Washington Post, on their editorial pages, we realize in looking back at what our papers were saying in the run up to the war, we were putting stories that emphasized the administration position and the Ahmad Chalabi position. Those were getting on the front page, and somewhere back about page 824, there was a story about intelligence estimates that were contrary to what the administration was pushing. And if you were reading blogs at that point, especially if you're reading progressive blogs, you would know those stories. You would have known those stories were front and center every day, and you were getting reminded of daily of questions about how the intelligence was being manipulated, questions about how the intelligence was being disseminated, what the administration was doing with the intelligence.
I'd like to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Tom Sumner. Tom is an editor at William James & Company, a series of books based on progressive blogs, or I like to think of it left-wing. I don't mind being called a left-winger. The topics covered in Project Rewire, the book that we should be, you know, focusing on, but this whole thing is all part and parcel of the same thing. The Dan Rather incident, which is classic Atwater-Rovian technique, by the way. He was set up and knocked down and didn't even know it. You'd think a guy like that would be smarter. You'd think his producers would be smarter. You'd think his staff would be smarter. But they also talk about the Kerry campaign and Fox News. Talk about the Downing Street memo. Boy, there's a golden oldie already, huh? The alleged liberal bias in media. I've yet to determine that anywhere. And Cindy Sheehan. And this is just the beginning. And there are several other topics in here. This is maybe slightly off topic, but I'd like your thoughts on this. I'm thinking of two journalists, I.F. Stone and Bob Woodward. Now, I.F. Stone to me is, you know, God Almighty, okay? And the quote I've been spreading around the last few weeks is something I picked up reading a review of the biography of I.F. Stone. And that is, I.F. Stone said that if it's a reporter's job to report what a public official says, it's also a reporter's job to report whether that public official is lying or not. I.F. Stone, on a shoestring, basically used the government's own words against the government. He would take government reports, filter out the BS, and come up with the real story as opposed to the story that the White House was putting out, the managed news. That was the Johnson administration in those days, Democrats. The other guy is Bob Woodward. I mean, he's been dining out for 30 years on the fact that he helped bring down Dick Nixon, and he's gotten so cozy with the powers that be in Washington of whatever administration, whatever political party, that he's become part of the problem. Any thoughts about that?
Well, it's telling that Woodward's new book reflects the zeitgeist. You know, 5 or 6 years ago when he was writing Bush at War, there was no he didn't have any reason to be to run contrary to the administration. He's, you know, I stated, and I have not read it, whether it's how insightful it is or how great it, I think you've got it exactly right. He's, you know, proverbially sticking up his finger, see which way the wind blows. He can capitalize on that. And if everything had gone absolutely swimmingly in this purported, you know, war on terror, if Afghanistan were a fledgling, you know, great egalitarian society, and same with Iraq,
yuck.
There would have been no, there would have been no state of denial. Fact is, public opinion has pushed so far against the Iraq war. And, you know, we shouldn't forget that, by the way, that public opinion is very much against the Iraq war, regardless of what you may hear on the news reports.
But we have no Walter Cronkite now, no Big Daddy to say, you know what, we're losing and it's just terrible, let's get out. There's nobody that trusted anymore.
Right. But to get back to I.F. Stone for just a second.
Sure, yeah.
You know, you could say he's a real model for the blogosphere. Run on a shoestring. He's literally working, you know, 12-hour day is probably a short day for I.F. Stone.
That's on weekends, 12 hours.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, never stopping for a second continually questioning what's being put out.
Never taking the government handout unless he uses it as a model for research.
That's right.
You take the government handout and you fact check everything in the government handout using other government handouts.
Another great thing that goes back to the I.F. Stone quote, since we're throwing those around, is he also said, the great thing about the New York Times is you never know where you'll find a front page story.
That's exactly right. Isn't that a shame? Same with the Washington Post. I mean, I respect those two papers a lot, but sometimes it hurts me to do that. And you'll see the big story on page one, on A1, it'll say troops enter Baghdad. And then on page 828, it'll say the troops encountered resistance of this and that. It was a disaster. But all you're getting – oh, we can talk about embedded reporters too, because they're at least one of the blogs printed here talks about embedding reporters. I think of Ernie Pyle, the great World War II reporter. All reporters in World War II were embedded. They were all part of the platoons, battalions, whatever it was that they were assigned to. They ate with the guys. They slept with the guys. They got shot at with the guys. They were one of the guys. But I think we're all agreed that World War II is like the last great moral war, and everything since then has been kind of questionable. And when they didn't embed the reporters in Kuwait in Gulf War I, they got some really viciously critical stories. So they just went back to the old ways. Make the reporter one of the guys, and you're not going to get a bad story.
Well, the media gets manipulation of the media in the U.S. has become has become a work in progress, and the Iraq War was an attempt to, or Gulf War II or whatever you want to call it, was an attempt, I think, improve upon their media manipulation in Gulf War I. And when Gulf War I was happening, I was in a position where the only news that I could get was on cable news. So
CNN's war.
And I was I happened to be living in Japan, and you'd go and you'd gather around the TV set as the U.S. went to invade Iraq and oust Iraq out of Kuwait. The predominant visual I have of that was Norman Schwarzkopf up giving his briefings.
That in the video game war, you know.
The video game war. Yeah. That's right. Well, apparently, in this round, they decided to amp that up a little bit and, you know, embed all reporters. And, you know, it really is an unbelievable thing to witness. A reporter, for example, is brought up in Project Rewire talking about participating in a military action. Unbelievable.
Yes, it is. But again, this is not unknown. It was not unknown in World War II for a reporter to pick up an M1 rifle and actually start defending the guys he was living with. So,
well, you get in with the platoon, and that's what happens. You become part of
one of the guys.
One of the guys.
Yeah. So, listen, before I forget, where can you get William James Company books? Where can we buy them around town?
Well, of course, you can buy them in, online. They're our web address is William James and Company is WMJASCO.com, WilliamJasco.com. Also available at your other internet superstores, which we won't mention, mm-hmm. but people can go find them.
They don't need any introduction from us.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Around town, you'll find them at Powell's and other fine booksellers.
Okay, good. So let's take a guy like Greg Palast. Greg Palast is in here also. Greg Palast is on our air a lot. We call him from time to time. He's always on Air America one way or another. I imagine Greg Palast is probably the best known journalist who can't get printed in the United States, probably in history. Why can't he get a U.S. gig? Do you have any thoughts on that? I mean, Palast is represented in this book. He's funny. He's pointed. He tells what he conceives of as the truth, which turns out to be most of the time the truth. Why won't the U.S. outlets touch him?
Well, Harper's will.
Yeah, okay.
But that's
again, preaching to a small choir.
That's
much.
Right. You've got to go find it. It's not a pervasive thing. His story about the 2000 election and the taking of Florida, and again 2004 in Ohio. But he really goes beyond Ohio, talking about New Mexico, Nevada, all the states whose electoral vote should be questioned and can validly be questioned. Those are his most important stories. Perhaps you can tell me why he's not in the U.S.
I thought you might have some thoughts on the
we've sort of answered it in our previous discussion.
Maybe we did.
You know, it's not an environment that's going to, there's another new book on the media out currently by Jeff Cohen of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and he points out that it's just so blatant in the cable news arena, these FCC regulations, and we talk about the doings of the Federal Communications Commission in Project Rewire, but he points out that working within cable news and working at MSNBC, they really were doing the Bush administration a favor, offering military punditry about the Iraq war, for example. And in return, this FCC bill that was going to be passed in 2003, which didn't by overwhelming outcry of the public, this was payback for their help in getting a longtime goal of Bush cronies to get into Iraq. Helping them to do that in that kind of environment, what's a guy like Greg Palast going to do?
That's a good question. I first started to get annoyed at Reagan press conferences where I kept asking myself, why are they throwing this old schmuck all these softball questions? Why don't they ask him something hard? I feel the same way about George Bush. I mean, never mind about Iraq and never mind about Afghanistan and never mind about No Child Left Behind. Why don't they ask him about the hunger policy in this country. It's something that would throw him off the talking points. They just never do it.
No, they don't. Well, it's long been reported that his press conferences are scripted, mm-hmm. No follow-up questions. And you go back to, quote, Elizabeth Bumiller of the New York Times writing about the run-up to the war. And her quote was something to the effect of, you'll have to paraphrase, you know, at that, in that environment, who were we to question the president? Well,
oh, you Dan were the Rather press. Said pretty much the same thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Dan Rather said pretty much the same thing. Jim Lehrer, in one of the posts that we republish in Project Rewire, is talking to Chris Matthews about the very same thing.
Mm-hmm.
He even went so far as to say, who would have even thought of it? Nobody was smart enough
to come up
with that question.
Everybody raise your hand who would have thought of that.
He should have been reading the political blogs. That's what he should
have been doing. He should have been doing his job, is what he should have been, instead of getting in bed with the politicians. I got to ask you one more question. Why do you hate America?
What a great question.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I gotta believe that if we really didn't think that this was worth the effort to question all of this, that, we wouldn't be doing it. And you got to ask the people who are just plugged into cable news and taking the party line and sticking with their government, whatever they say. You got to ask them why they hate America. Mm-hmm. I mean, isn't this what we, fought the Cold War over?
Supposedly.
You have
all these rights unless you actually try to use them.
Right, to protect your liberty and your freedom to question.
I've been speaking with Tom Sumner. Tom is the editor of a series with William James Company on, printing left-wing blogosphere entries and introducing people who might not be familiar with the blogosphere to people like Joshua Michael Marshall and David Sirota. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me, Ed.